Yeah, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome to the GatheringHistory.com website, Jim Carr. And Jim, first of all, you're very, very welcome.
Thanks very much.
And I'm sure, Jim, you know, having travelled around the world over these past years, the love that I've always said this, the love that people, Dundalk people, have for Dundalk, it's an unusual kind of relationship to have with Dundalk, isn't it? Would I be wrong saying that, Jim?
I remember, particularly when we went to places where there would have been large, say, emigration to the likes of Australia, in say Melbourne or Sydney, that we would come across so many people from not just from Ireland but from our hometown of Dundalk. It was incredible the amount of people that are in Australia that have emigrated from here, and just so fond of the town, missing it so much, of course, you know, and you know, being the other side of the world like that, it's not an easy thing for them to get back. You know, they're lucky if they can get back maybe once around Christmas, so they long for Dundalk and for the Dundalk people, and that was evident very much in Australia and in America as well.
Now, the gathering, which is, there was an awful lot of people and very high profile people like Gabriel Byrne and these who ran it down and everything. But I have to say myself, now, Jim, I don't think it'll do any harm. And it's letting people know, maybe jog their memory, geez, maybe I might go back.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, by and all, it's a good idea, trying to get, you know, an influx of people into the country, spending money, hopefully. You know, that can't but help. So, you know, it's a good thing overall. I don't understand why people would be putting it down. I can understand that it's not an absolute solution to the crisis that we're in as a country. But certainly, it can't hurt.
We could certainly do with them coming and spending a few quid anyway, couldn't we?
Absolutely, yeah. Particularly in Dundalk.
Yeah. Now, Jim, growing up in Dundalk, now, the name Carr, funny, I was talking to my son Trevor last night, and he was asking me whereabouts the Carr, was the Carr real Dundalk name, you know, and I was telling him that my first memory of the Carr name was Peter Carr,
yes.
Of course, the famous footballer who played with Everton.
Yeah.
And have you great memories of the soccer connection, Jim, or were you past that again, you grew to be interested even in sport?
Dad had obviously filled me in.
He was a good footballer himself, of course. Your dad, yeah,
too. He was. And he'd filled me in about how well Peter had done, and you know, we've all the photographs of him. You know, when he played for Ireland and played for Everton and Preston. And it was kind of an interesting story because my grandfather, he comes from Coal Island in County Tyrone. And he served his apprenticeship as a grocer in Cavan, I believe it was, where he met my grandmother. And they decided to get married and they moved to Dundalk. And he bought a shop in Seatown Place.
Where Smith's the chemist is now, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. Originally he lived in Jocelyn Street and then he moved down and moved above the shop. It was called James Coors. And Peter, his son, had originally been playing Gaelic, and what happened was when Peter then decided he wanted to go professional soccer and make a bit of money out of this, it didn't go down too well with the family at all, and I believe that the father never spoke to him for quite a while because he was very, you know, very nationalistic, full of nationalistic pride, and you know, you were defecting to the other side.
Was it the soccer? Well, that was the problem, was it? Soccer?
Purely.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. I mean, he came around to it eventually. And Peter was an extremely good footballer, you know, and I have very fond memories of Peter. He's dead now, unfortunately. But, yeah, I would have heard Dad speaking about him an awful lot, and still I come across people in Dundalk that knew him well and that had an opportunity to play with him, you know.
Like, when you think of it now, though, it was an unbelievable thing, somebody from Dundalk, you know, going and playing with Everton and Prestonot and an Irish international. Okay, we've had a few since then, but they're very limited, Stephen Staunton and a few other people. But, like, it was huge at the time, wasn't it, you know?
It was, and, you know, a good friend of mine, Niall O'Hagan, was pointing out to me recently just the calibre of people that have got into top positions around the world, not just in football, in entertainment, but, say, in the likes of physicists, you know, the top of their legal profession, people from Dundalk that have done extremely well. You tend not to hear about them so much. But certainly this Dundalk and County Louth has given birth to very, very talented people.
And for such a small little area that we're in, you
yes.
know.
Yes.
Jim, what's your memories of growing up in Dundalk? And would you say to me that there were very happy times? Or, I mean, let's be very honest here. There was people... Your dad worked in the ESB,
yeah.
and my dad worked on the railway. Mm. Now, the difference in income to the different houses was a hell of a lot. My father's just a labourer. Mm. Your dad worked in the ESB. They were well paid. And so was there any shortage of money or what was your feelings growing up in your house?
Our parents did their very best to make ends meet as best they could, and in fact they had they had two jobs. Dad worked in the ESB as a payroll manager, and also my mum worked for a spell in Dalgan Milk Products, as it was known then, and they also of course had the band going, so they're mm-hmm. working semi-professionally as a group. A couple of nights a week, doing weddings, doing pub gigs,
Very successful. So we
never needed for anything. I think, luckily and thankfully to our parents, I think that when my mother and father first got together, they wouldn't have had a huge amount of money, and Dad bought his plot in Ardassman,
yeah.
which he bought it for £50.
Yeah.
£50.
And you remember the late PC Logan?
Yes.
He lived up beside us up there.
Yes.
And he worked with your dad in the ESB.
That's right.
And Petey never stopped telling everybody about that site in
yeah.
Ardesmond.
and they
built the house on that
site. They built the house. And I'd say, you know, money would have been scarce around that time.
Mm-hmm.
But they were very, very hardworking and very loving parents. And we were very lucky to have them both looking after us. And so thankfully we didn't... You know, we never really needed for anything, you know, luckily.
Jim, when music obviously was in your house, so I know that you were friends with my eldest son, and there's a few stories that I'm sure that you
best
could tell me about
unsaid.
That. One or two of them I got involved myself, which I shouldn't have, but however, that's another
I
story.
I do apologise. Yeah. It's all youthful.
You know what that's all about, anyway.
I do.
When you used to be on the television and everything like that, I'd be saying, you see that fellow there? I know something about that fellow, you know. But Jim, the music obviously was a route, because I remember you being in a couple of talent competitions that I judged, and do you remember the one with Gid Mac and
yes,
and
yeah.
in the Derryhill? What was the name of the group?
Cry,
yeah.
Yes.
And so, like, from the word go, was music more that you were into than football and other things?
I enjoyed football. I didn't take it too seriously, though. Perhaps I should have. We grew up in a very musical environment, with our parents playing and practicing
in
music for the gigs that they were going to be doing at the weekend constantly. And so there was always a radio on in the house. And we grew up absolutely loving music. But to be very honest, it took me a long time, I suppose. Well, I was probably about 21 when I fully decided then that I was going to go professional in music. But up until that, I was toying with various different things. I went to the Friary School, and then once my
were they happy times in the Friary School?
To be honest, I didn't enjoy that school. No, I didn't.
Were you good at school, or was the teachers just too hard for you?
I was okay in primary, and then secondary, once I discovered... girls, my schooling went out the window. So I wouldn't have been very academic then. I probably am an awful lot more. I'm an awful lot more interested in history and geography now than I would have been then growing
up. Jim, would you blame an awful lot of it on the system of education, the way they? I mean, the difference between the kids going to school these days and when we went to school is unbelievable. Like, how much they love going to school. I don't know about you, but I hated school from the word go. Hated it. You know, was it as bad as that for you?
I enjoyed primary school in the Redeemer. I didn't enjoy secondary school, but I think if I had have worked at it, I would have enjoyed it enough more. I was in the Christian Brothers.
Well, that was difficult.
And I had great teachers, yeah. And I had the height of respect for Prunchis Kunig, Frank Cooney.
Yeah, he's still a great man. I see him regularly.
Man. Yeah, lovely man. I've actually met up with him not so long ago.
Nice
had a pint of Guinness with him. Lovely man. No, but if I had worked at it, I think I would have enjoyed it more. But really, I was distracted with electronics, with music, and with girls, not necessarily in that order. I'm serious, though. I was. I just ended up having no interest. And it was only after I left school that I then went to the Royal Irish Academy of Music, and I started studying music properly.
What did you study in there?
Piano, classical piano. I was studying under a guy called Peter Daines.
And did you like that type of music?
You
weren't pushed for it, were you, Jim? By your
dad? I think it's great for upgrading your skills as a pianist. It's very, very good. Again, I at that point was getting more into composition. And I think it was very shortly afterwards that I managed to get my first little recording studio, not unlike your mixing desk there. It was just a little Tascam Porta studio. Mm. And for me, the joy of being able to overdub and, you know, put guitar on with a keyboard track that you've already done.
Did you spend much time at that? Was a pastime at this stage, wasn't it?
I did, yeah. Yeah, I spent an awful lot of time. And that's when it really started to... When I was able to compose music, that's when I was... When I really, really started to enjoy it, you know?
And Jim, just before we forget about them, your three beautiful sisters, and were they interested in music as you were growing up, the same as you?
They loved music deeply, and you know, Andrea, I've memories of Andrea. She would come in from school, and she'd go and sit on her favorite chair, and she'd put on her favorite music, and she would just bump to the music, and. Yeah, Sharon played with the Irish Youth Orchestra. She played with. She studied under Father Brendan McNally. Yeah,
they're wonderful. He was a wonderful, wonderful man.
Yes,
he still is.
Yeah.
But you know, the amount of education they gave to people like Sharon and other people that was talented was unbelievable.
Yeah, he was an incredible man.
He was.
What he did for Dundalk was amazing. Particularly, I mean, the students that have come out of Ravensdale are top class, world class. Yeah. He's amazing. We all loved music, but it was.
Well, did you ever get together and play? Did you ever go to and play with your mum and dad in the pubs or anything like that?
We didn't as a band, but when I was about 15, I joined my parents' band, Sound Affair, and I used to play in the Mehaven Inn.
I was trying to think of the name this morning, Sound Affair,
The Mehaven Inn, what's it called now? The Malt House. Used to play in the Coachman's. My God, I went up to the Coachman's there recently with Dad, and it's such a sad sight.
A brilliant place, wasn't it?
Derelict. It's so sad to see it, because when Michael Boyle ran it, it was just... It was amazing. It was just
my favorite. Where every time I pass it, like yourself, Jim, mixed grill of a Sunday evening.
Yes,
you know it was a brilliant place. Absolutely brilliant place.
It was. Yeah. So I played. I played with my parents a couple of Friday and Sunday. I think they allowed me Saturday off, and that was great experience.
And would you have got a few quid for that?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was your first your first kind of professional kind of thing. But now when we mentioned earlier on there about Cry and all the boys that you knocked around with and all very, very musical, was it your ambition at that time to join a band like that, like Cry?
It was kind of more of a sideline. And then there was at one point, I remember that we had this discussion because I had decided that I wanted to take a very serious approach to the music. And I had a discussion with the lads, and some of them were on for it and some of them weren't. You know, some of them always wanted to view the music as a sideline. And really, if for anybody who wants to make it in music, you cannot view it as a sideline. It has got to be your main focus. You know, you kind of got to be married to it for it to work. That's been my experience. And I certainly would have liked to have gone a lot further with that band. I thought we'd huge potential. But it wasn't to be, but it was a wonderful experience.
Now, at all of that time, you still haven't mentioned your first job. Did you work at all?
Oh, I did. Oh, I certainly did.
Did you?
Well, I
you give the impression there, do you see, that you were having a great time playing the piano and
not all at all.
So tell me about
your job. I worked in the Imperial Hotel. I worked in the Punters. I worked in the Ashley Arms.
As a barman?
Not as a barman. I was too young. I served the tables I cleaned a few toilets, I have to say. Not the most pleasant of experience, but I did. And worked with Peter Quinn for quite a while in the Imperial. And I've this memory of picking up peas, sweeping up the peas after the Sunday night concert they would have. A Horslips played one time there, I believe. They'd be served like fish and peas and potatoes, and it would just end up everywhere. And I used to have to sweep it up. But yeah, that's what I did. I also went into initially as a summer job into Tesco's, and I ended up staying there for 3 years.
In the old dog shopping centre?
Dunn Stores. Just down the road.
Down beside you.
I worked there for about 3 years, stacking shells, and I met some wonderful people there, and I still run into them occasionally. And it was good times, you know. I had no responsibilities, no pressure. The little bit of money that I was saving, I was able to then eventually spend on more recording equipment. And then, just when I turned 21, I believe, I decided at that point that this is just not going to work. I've got to force myself out of this situation and possibly go to London, whatever, and concentrate on music.
What kind of music, though, were you talking about that time?
I had no idea.
No idea. Okay.
I had no idea. I was just going to move over, like Harry, like your son, like Patrick.
Yeah.
And just going to, throw myself into the deep end.
You handed in your notice, Jim.
So I handed in my notice, a week's notice. And within a week, I got a phone call from Keith Malloy of the Malloys.
Yeah.
And he said, listen, we're short a keyboard player. Would you be interested in coming and joining us? And this was literally within like a week or 2 weeks of me handing in my notice. I mean, talk about providence. And I said, of course, I always thought the Malloys were amazing. I said, of course. And so I went about a month later, then I flew out to Bologna in Italy and met them there. And I was with them for a year and a half, and we'd wonderful times.
I suppose, Jim, it'd be very wrong of us just to pass it over like that about the Malloys, because like Jackie Orla, Dara and Keith, no one has, well, a lot of people do know, but the work that they put into and still do.
Yes.
They're wonderful even to this day.
Absolutely.
They're a brilliant, brilliant family.
Yeah. Amazing work ethic as a family, you know, and it taught me an awful lot. I lived with them in a place called Mainz Castell, just outside of Frankfurt, and we toured all of the American army bases and the British army bases as well. That was the circuit that we were on. And it was just amazing. It was amazing to see the way that they worked together, you know, and the work that they put in. They worked extremely hard, you know. And I learned an awful lot from them, and I'm thankful.
Now, just when, Jim, did you get involved with the girls as regards music?
Well, after I finished up with the Malloys, I came back home and I moved to Dublin, and I set up a small studio, and I started recording people and producing people. And I also started working as a session musician.
You weren't a manager like or any. You were just.
No. I was doing production and I was doing session keyboard work. And I joined Linda Martin when she'd finished with Chips. I joined her. I was in her band. I also worked with Red Hurley. Worked with various others. I also worked with Dolores Keane, and I think that was kind of a pivotal moment for me when I joined her, because I always had a love for Irish traditional music, but when I joined her, I just fell in love with it completely.
She's a wonderful artist.
Oh, she's amazing. Yeah. She was amazing. We had wonderful times. In fact, I had my first Indian meal with her the very first night after the gig, and she introduced me to Indian food, and I fell in love with it. But that was great experience. It was, you know, I would have taken a lot of the, I would have been very inspired by what I was doing with her and the music that she introduced me to. And, you know, I took elements of that into what became eventually the Coeur Sand.
Was, at that time, that was traditional. It was completely, though, different sound than what the Coeurs came to. How did you get together, though, with the girls? Like, did you come back to Dundalk and say, we're going to start a band, or how did it... How did it?
Yeah, I was telling you that I did some production and writing and recording with various artists. One guy that I met was a guy called John Hughes. And his sister was involved with Hubbard Casting, and they were casting the movie The Commitments. And I asked him if he would allow myself and my sisters to audition. And he arranged that for us, and we did. And it went very well, and we all got kind of blink and you'll miss it parts in The Commitments. Andrea got a more substantial role.
She was. It was on recently there, looking at her again.
Yeah. And at that point then... I decided then to give up what I was doing in Dublin and move home and then start working with the girls full time. So I rented a house.
Because of the commitments, the way it went there, you were happy with the way it went. Is that what you mean, Jim?
Yeah.
Well, gives you something to think about.
We got up, and since part of the audition, we got up and we played two tracks on stage, and we loved it. And I just thought, you know, this has got great potential. I mean, I knew how talented my sisters were anyway, but, you know, the only small problem was that two of them were still at school in the Louis. But I thought that at least if we work in our spare time and then, you know, wait until they're actually finished school, then it'll all come together. So I moved back home and I rented the Gate Lodge at Bunny Cox's, the horse training place, just beside the ESB station on the back of the wall, and set up a recording studio there. And we worked, we did all the pre-production for the first album for Forgiven Not Forgotten, and did all the writing there, most of the writing. And that was it, yeah. That's where it started, basically.
And Jim, when you started writing the songs and putting them together and out there in the back of the wall, as we'd call it, had you any idea at all that this was going to take off, or were you really confident, or how did you feel?
We were so single-mindedly focused on the goal of achieving success that we didn't entertain it not happening. Though... We had a few major knocks, as any band has, you know, throughout the course of their pre-career. We got turned down by record companies when we thought we were going to be signed, but it turned out to be a blessing in disguise that we weren't, because then we were signed with one of the major record labels in the world, Atlantic Records, That was all a slow process. I think it took 3 or 4 or 5 years before anything started to move. So we were putting in the hard graft, the writing, the recording.
Were you gigging at that time?
We were invited over. This was another pivotal moment when we were invited by a friend of Bill Whelan's, Gene Kennedy Smith, over to the Kennedy Library in Boston to play this gig, and which we did. And we played mainly traditional Irish music. And... that allowed us the opportunity to go meet with a load of record companies in Los Angeles and New York. And it was on the second last day before we left New York that we met with Atlantic Records, a guy called Jason Flom there. And we also, excuse me, we had been trying to reach a guy called David Foster, who was working in the Hit Factory with Michael Jackson at the time. And we couldn't get a meeting set up, so we decided... to just arrive down at the studio. And so we dressed up as best we could in those days and took our instruments and went down to the studio to the Hit Factory, and the security allowed us in, and David Foster was still there. And he took us out. He came down about 15 minutes later to the lobby, and he took us up to the studio, and we played live for him, and we also played a couple of demos, and he just said, that is just, I have to give you an A+. And he says, that is fantastic. And then we got a call later on that evening to say that we were being signed to Atlantic Records and that David Foster was going to produce us.
Just like that.
Yeah, but it's not just like
that,
you see. If you take into consideration all of the work that preceded that, all of the hard grafts, all of the knocks that we received, you know, it didn't just happen overnight, do you know what I mean?
No, and Jim, I'd have to say to you, families, working with families, it's very difficult, I'm sure you'll agree with me there. But all during that time of the writing and everything like that, was the pressure on you? And how did your mum and dad cope with it?
There wasn't a huge amount of pressure on us with the first album because, you know, it had taken us years to write all the material. But when it came to doing the second album, there was a huge amount of pressure on us then to deliver hits. That was tough. But our parents were just so thrilled, our mum and dad, with what was happening. They're so delighted. We brought them out to Malibu, where we were recording the album, and they stayed for a couple of weeks with us out there. They were just thrilled with what was happening, you know, just so excited for us. They missed us being away, of course. It was always very, you know, memories of my mum at the airport, you know, crying with us leaving, you know. And that was tough. But, and then working with family can be very difficult. We were lucky that you know, we had the bond of the music was the gel, was the cement, that kept us together. We had our moments, as every family does, of tiffs. Some of them were weren't the nicest of rows, but you know, that's just inevitable. If you're in a kind of a cocooned environment with the same people, even if they're not your family, 24/7, that's very 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 difficult. And sometimes, you know, you just have to let off steam, and that happened. But by and all, we got on very well with each other, generally, luckily. You know, otherwise it would have been hell.
Jim, there was, and I'm sure you won't mind me saying this to you, but there was an awful lot of talk about the Three Beautiful Girls and Jim Carr. I mean, you must have known. Did that any effect on you, or did you laugh it off, or what, during those times?
I suppose I just laughed it off.
You're a good-looking fellow anyway. I don't know why they were saying things like that about you, Jim.
I was there to make the girls look good. Yeah. I was known as the ugly sister in the course. The ugly sister. I'm not going to lie, in this day and age, it's a good asset. You know, it's a good asset to have if you've got members of the band that look well, you know. Unfortunately, that is the world that we live in.
The three beautiful-looking girls are very, very talented, and as you, of course, at the back. Yeah. As regards the presentation of the chorus, was brilliant, you know. Now, during when you were really, really big, Jim, I genuinely will say this to you. I never had anybody ever say to me that they didn't like the chorus. Personally, as a family, your dad and your mum, who was an absolutely wonderful woman, and I've memories of she was in Bowman Hospital at the same time my own wife was in. I remember talking to your dad above in the car park, and neither of them were very well, and both of them died very quickly after I was talking to him that day. But she was the her death had a big effect on you all, didn't she? Her death.
Yeah, it was dreadful. Nothing quite prepares you for the death of a parent, you know. We were devastated. We were totally devastated. It took us a long, long time to come. You never fully accept it, but you know, it took us a long time to even come to terms with it. Your values in life change. You know, I suppose that's the good thing about, you know, a death in the family, that, you know, you start to look at life very differently. You see what you understand what is important and what isn't, you know, and trivial things that you might have worried about on a day-to-day basis just pale into insignificance in comparison to something like this, you know. And she was a wonderful, wonderful mum. She was so good to us, you know. It looked after us so well, and she loved what we were doing. She was the proudest mum in the world, you know. with her children doing so well, because she knew and understood the amount of hard work that went into what we were doing, you know.
Jim, did your mum and dad travel much to see you when you were at your height, travelling around? Would they meet up with you in different places and stuff like that?
Yeah, well, obviously they would have come to all of the gigs in Ireland.
Yeah.
They came to quite a few in London as well. I believe they came to Paris. We flew them out for a holiday for three weeks out to Australia, and their holiday started off in Cairns, I believe it was. It's kind of close to the rainforest. And it was great that we were able to do that for them. They came to America as well. They came to Malibu, and of course they loved seeing us live. They came as often as they could.
Now, your dad, after your mum's death, I know it did take a lot out of your dad, but he was great support on his own, wasn't he? You would see him. People would be talking to him, and he was like an agent, if you know. Not, I don't mean an agent, but he was always there. For you, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, of course. Yeah, he was, of course. I think that, you know, being honest, when we were growing up, you know, the thoughts of getting together and, you know, making music our sole focus would not have been first choice for our mum, because she would have thought you need to, you know, get the academics right first of all.
Right.
You know, get yourself educated academically. This is what had been her. And, you know, she was right to a certain extent. You know, but Dad, whereas, was the opposite, I think, in that, you know, go with where your talents and your gifts lie. And I tend to side with Dad in relation to that. So he was always hugely supportive. I mean, he started us off on piano years ago. He taught Caroline and Andrew and Sharon as well, piano, you know. That, you know, it's just hugely supportive, and, you know, we can only thank him for that.
Now, Jim, as regards the end, when you decided what was the main reason that you decided to stop the band?
What, do you know what? It was just circumstances, really. And it was the thing is, when one of the band members gets pregnant. And kids come on the scene, you know, there's another focus, there's a new focus. And, you know, we as a family obviously had to prioritise, and as individuals, as parents, we had to prioritise.
And I suppose, Jim, if going through the time, you must have realised that at some stage, you know, those three gorgeous girls were going to have babies and get married. And
yeah,
it must have been something that was down the line.
I think we were very lucky that we got the amount of time that we did. We got about 15 years at it, you know, at the music. And so we've given birth to the next generation of... another band for the next generation, of course, who knows. But yeah, that's the way it goes. It wasn't a decision that we made to stop. We had toured so the planet so extensively and worked so intensively that we needed a break from it anyway.
How long could you have kept going with that pressure, Jim?
Well, I think it would be different for an all-male band. I'd say it's very different for the likes of U2, who could keep possibly touring the world constantly. You know, we couldn't do that. We used to pick we'd have our tour, we'd go out for about six, maybe 3 months maximum, and then, you know, we'd come home for a break. But as I said, you know, things change once children come on the scene.
Now, the girls are, particularly Sharon, who is very high profile with the voice, which she's brilliant at, absolutely brilliant at. And Andrea is made singles and everything, and still very high profile. Caroline, you don't see very much of. Is that deliberate that she plays a low profile?
Well, she's living in Mallorca, and she's looking after three children, and taking up her time, all of her time. But so Caroline is good. I mean, she's still playing music. As far as I know, she's still writing. She has taken up cycling. I'm talking about, like, probably professional cycling,
really?
like her husband. Yeah, so she will be cycling up and down the hills and the mountains in Mallorca. That's what she does to keep fit. So, and she was always very much about fitness herself. But that's what she's doing. I've actually come full circle, because I've gone and got myself involved with Keith Malloy, and we're writing and recording at the moment. In fact, that's where I'll be going after this interview. What we're doing is we're writing as much material as we can with a view to getting behind an artist or a number of artists. So we're looking for singers at the moment.
That's a coincidence, starting off with Keith, and then ending up with him now again. Everything that's happened in between that, it's a dream, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
And Jim, can you remember the final gig that you did with the three girls?
I think, if I'm correct, the final gig that we did was in Ischgl in Austria, in the snow. It was the opening of this skiing season. As far as I remember, that was the final one, and it was an amazing gig. It was outdoor, and it was very, very cold.
Did you announce that it was your final gig? Did everybody know it was your final?
I think we might have. You know, we said, but you know, we didn't say it was final, because you know it's not final. Who knows when we might get together? In fact, we might get together and do something this year, but I can't say any more about that at the moment. But you know, we weren't thinking finals or finality at that point. It just says, okay, we knew that we're going to take a break for a while, but so that we look after kids. You know, I've got a 6-year-old son as well, who I look after. So, you know, it was never with a view to completely stopping.
Now, just excuse me, I don't want to go into, I did interviews with you about the path you took then for a couple of years, but it was completely different to music. And are you glad you went into all of that, Jim? Because you did get a hard time, didn't you?
Well, I knew I would. I said it to my friends at the time. You know, I'm going to get discredited. I'm going to get ridiculed. That's just the way that it works. Because I'd seen it happen so many
times. And they all did it
people.
In the Late Late Show on TVM, the whole lot of them.
Yeah, it's like, they're like, shut that guy up, you know. Yeah. It's, if they cannot assassinate you, if you're out there speaking the truth as you see it, they will assassinate your character. And I experienced that. And certainly elements of the media were pretty unfair. You know, and it's, I found that if they couldn't attack my argument, they would attack me. And one thing that they did was, because we've had discussions, you know the stuff that I talk about. I've never talked about aliens or reptilians or anything like that. Yet the media
they
threw that at me because it helps to marginalise you through ridicule. So people go, oh,
Jim, a good example of what you're talking about was the appearance on The Late Late Show.
Yeah.
Where they had somebody set up in the audience and do you remember that?
Well, that's another card they play, is the anti-Semitic card, you know? And I'd be pro-Semitic, but they threw the anti-Semitic card at me.
Yeah.
And again, I suppose when I came out initially on the Matt Cooper show years ago, I was naive into thinking that, you know, elements of the media got to support this because there are glaring holes, say, for instance, in the whole 9/11 story. And I think that if you were to do a poll nowadays, most people would question the official story of 9/11 at least. I felt that I had a duty to speak my mind about this because I knew that there were other people doing it in various different countries, particularly in America, but there wasn't anybody at that time doing it in Ireland. So I came out and did it, and I have absolutely no regrets. I'm very proud of what I did. I think that I would perhaps change my delivery in the first interview that I did. And I think a mistake that I made was to talk about too many subjects, you know, in a short space of time. You know, you're better off sticking on one. Yeah. But I would not change any of the content that I said. I wouldn't change anything about the Lisbon Treaty. I've been proven right about so many things. And even the whole fluoride issue that we talked on the other radio station. You know, a Harvard University study came out recently and said that it lowers the IQ of children. sodium fluoride.
You and know, you have to say, now, for somebody like myself that wouldn't know a hell of a lot about that, but I remember being at your night out in the Lisdoo,
yeah,
and there was a huge crowd there that night. And I have to say, and I'm not saying it because you're here this morning or anything, but it was one of the most interesting nights that I think I've ever had.
Oh,
because you get carried, not carried away, but you start to think. You know, I mean,
yeah,
it's there's something in it, you know. But you, yeah, didn't get that from the media. You got it from the audiences that were around with you,
yeah,
going to your talks. Would I be right saying,
yeah,
that?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I felt compelled to do this, to kind of bring this information to people. And it's kind of, it was vocational. You know, there was nothing to gain from it except that I felt that I was doing the right thing. And I wanted to try and help wake up my fellow Irish men and women to what was going on, because, you know, I love this country deeply and I love the Irish people. And yeah, I remember that particular talk down in the Lisdoo. Obviously it's very challenging, the information that I was presenting, because we're, unfortunately, whether we realise it or not, if we get most of our news from the mainstream media, we're indoctrinised and we're conditioned and we're propagandised to a certain extent, and depending on the newspaper, maybe to a large extent, but that's been my understanding. So it was challenging information, and it is, and some of it is still very challenging for me as well, but it had to be done, and I'm very proud that I did that.
Will you do it again? Will you resurrect it?
Well, I don't know what the future holds. All I know is that, you know, I love music, and I've turned back to music now completely. And working away with Keith is just such a dream. We make a great musical partnership, and that's what I absolutely love. And, you know, I know that I've woken up an awful lot of people who've gone out and who are doing the same things themselves, you know. But it takes an awful lot out of you. I'm a human being, of course, and I have to say that some of the things that were written about me were quite hurtful. But that's just the way that it works. That's the way, and I understand that. So, and I forgive those people who wrote nasty things about me.
Jim, just I said at the very beginning of our little chat this morning about the love that people have from Dundalk, but you're a Dundalk person through and through. And if there's anybody, we'll be putting this up on the website, and maybe there might be some people around the world that would be maybe thinking of coming to Ireland. You know, what would you say to them? I mean, people that come back haven't been to Dundalk for years, we'd say, you know.
Well, God, anybody out there who's thinking about coming back, please do, and particularly to the town of Dundalk. You know, it is a wonderful place. You know, there are places surrounding Dundalk that are just amazing. Carlingford, for instance, you know, a beautiful place. And, you know, it'll help give a wonderful boost to this county, and particularly to the town of Dundalk, if people were to come and experience it for what it is, the wonderful place that it is, and spend some money. We need your money.
And just finally, Jim, my final question I had in the back of my mind all morning, what I was going to ask you, but you already have answered it, actually, in the middle of the conversation there, when I said to you, when you said that you might be getting together again. Is it might, maybe, or will? The band, I mean.
I will say it's 95% leaning towards will. Is that safe?
That's safe.
And I can't say new so- at the
new,
moment.
New songs, Jim.
New songs with the band, that we will see about that. We're not writing at the moment. As I say, I'm writing with Keith Malloy at the moment. Sharon's independently doing her own thing, and she's writing as well. But who knows for the future? We'll see. Watch this space.
Jim, can I thank you very, very much indeed for coming in and talking to me this morning, giving up your time. I'm really delighted to see you. I've known Jim for a long, long time, and I'm delighted that I would call him a very good friend, because. And thank you very much indeed, Jim. Thank you, Jim. Help us make history by visiting our website on www.gatheringhistory.com.